Thank you so much, Erica, and thank you. Good afternoon to all of you, and welcome to the Council on Foreign Relations State and Local Officials webinar. I'm Irina Faskanis, Vice President for the National Program and Outreach at CFR. We're delighted to have participants from 40 states with us today. Thank you for taking the time to join us for this discussion, which is on the record. As you know, CFR is an independent and nonpartisan membership organization, think tank, and publisher focusing on U.S. foreign policy. Through our State and Local Officials Initiative, we serve as a resource on international issues affecting the priorities and agendas of state and local governments by providing analysis on a wide range of policy topics. CFR is also the publisher of Foreign Affairs Magazine. We are pleased to have Chike Agu with us today. We previously shared his bio with you, so I will just give you a few highlights on his distinguished career. Chike Agu works across sectors to create a future for all. He is the inaugural head of Economic Mobility Pathways at the Education Design Lab, where he leads the Community College Growth Engine Fund, an effort turning community colleges into bridges to careers in high growth fields. He is also a Technology and Human Rights Fellow at the Harvard Carr Center for Human Rights Policy, where he is writing a book on the future of work and racial inequity. And previously, he was senior principal and future work lead at the McChrystal Group. And he also served as a member of the Council on Foreign Relations Future of Work Task Force, a bipartisan group that came out with a report with policy recommendations. So Chike, thank you very much for being with us today. I thought you could talk first, get us started thinking about how the COVID-19 pandemic is affecting the nature of employment and trends in the U.S. workforce.
First of all, good afternoon. Thank you to the council for having me. Thank you to everyone who is on this call. The future of work is an issue that hits kind of both axes of the Eisenhower matrix. It is urgent and it is important. And the health outcomes and impacts of COVID, we have needed jobs we've never had before. In terms of the employment crisis, obviously we have 35 million to 40 million of our fellow Americans unemployed. And also we're having to contend now with inequities across a number of axes that we've had, that we've been here for a long time, but really now come to a head in this time of COVID-19. What I want to do is it's important to know what's the impact on the future of work and employment right now. Let's figure out where we were before COVID hit. Let's talk about what COVID has changed and what it hasn't. And then let's talk about some opportunities and then really want to throw it open for a conversation. So when we think about the future of work, I always lay out two very kind of concrete examples. One, which lay out both sides of the challenge. One is the challenge of for example, autonomous vehicles. Autonomous vehicles are going to be on the road en masse between 2030 and 2040, likely starting with commercial trucking, public transit. And if you look at the projections, it'll add almost $1 trillion in economic productivity to US GDP. The flip side of that is that driving a vehicle is also the most commonly held profession by an American man. And so between 2030 and 2040, a huge swath of our population, more people than the amount of school teachers that we have, will be out of work. And so the question is, what do we do about that? But those jobs, that technology obviates entirely. Secondly, you have a slightly different nuance of this problem. An example I always use here is the loan officer. If I think about when many of us were much younger or during our parents' time, a loan officer was a person you went to at a bank, you presented your documents, and they made a call about whether you get a loan or not. Today, that's not what a loan officer does. The person who actually makes the call or not about whether you get that loan is a computer algorithm that is a multivariate regression that takes into account a ton of different factors, and that out on balance is more accurate than a human being was. The job of the loan officer now is front-end recruitment, getting you in the door, and then also what we call account management on the back and making sure that you're happy and do additional loans with the bank. So the future of work before COVID had two dual challenges. You had a huge part of American jobs that may be obviated entirely by technology because they won't be needed. And then you have a huge other amount of jobs that are going to be irrevocably changed so quickly that workers may not be able to keep up. That is the challenge of the future of work, and that was where we were before COVID. When we think about the COVID challenges, those two things have been accelerated. So again, because now we cannot do things in person, on-site, the way that we used to, the need and the reliance on technology has only increased. We are seeing things done via technology, via a virtue that we never thought of before, but they're now happening. And so the question is, what are we going to do, again, about those jobs that are even more quickly being obviated? And then what are the jobs that are being trained? I'll use one example of some folks who may be on the call, but as we think about something as simple as education, again, I started my career as a school teacher in New York City. That entire profession is being changed. We still need teachers, but it's an entirely different skill set. How do you teach, facilitate virtually? How do you make sure students are still engaged? How do you make sure that you're able to give and collect work? Things like that, things that we never had to think about before. So COVID has only accelerated those trends. When we wrote our report on the future of work, when I was part of this task force 2 years ago, the report's called The Work Ahead. You can go to cfr.org/theworkahead. Still pull down the report and see a lot of our recommendations. We had really four key questions around the future of work that I still think are super important and plausible here, in which show the challenge and the opportunity. First question, how do we make sure that there actually is work? How do we make sure that we're creating enough jobs for our people to actually make the most of themselves, change the life of their families, and frankly, just subsist from day to day? Number two, how do we make sure our people have the capabilities and skills to do that work? Not just the technical skills, but frankly, what some people call the 21st century skills, what I like to call the human skills of leadership, communication, things like that, that will make them inviolable in this new economy, doing the things that machines can't do. Thirdly, how do we make sure that the work that needs to be done and the people who need work find each other? We have all had examples in our local markets of folks who need work, the people who needed it, who simply were not able to find each other because markets are inefficient. And also at times they're biased. Again, we have one example that I always love is that if you look at 2/3 of American administrative assistants today, they don't have a bachelor's degree. But if you look at 100% of job postings for an administrative assistant, they all require a bachelor's degree. So again, this is where, again, a mismatch of what people are looking for can keep worker and work from finding each other. And then lastly, how do you make sure that we have a system of supports that support a worker and a business along the way to make sure that we get to where we need to? And this is everything from insurance, which should be a lot easier to access than frankly it is in many jurisdictions, to accounts to pay for worker reskilling and worker training. And so those are our really four questions. And so when we look at how COVID has accelerated a lot of the trends that we talked about beforehand, it's that we have to now be able to, we have to deal with these issues on a quicker timeframe than we would have before. So let's look at potentially what are some of the opportunities. If we look at COVID again, we have seen a huge amount of unemployment. I'll say in my home state of Maryland, if you looked at April 2020 versus January 2020, and you looked at the amount of small businesses, we were down 45% on the amount of small businesses open than we were in January. But what we've also seen are, frankly, because of the situation that we're in, we've seen a demand for new types of jobs that we never saw before. None of us knew what contact tracing was 6 months ago. But now, depending on where you are in the city of, in a place like Baltimore City, you can make $35,000 to $50,000 doing contact tracing because we need it so desperately. Similarly, when we look at the allied health fields, we have been short of personnel for the last 3 or 4 months, and that may be a reality for that's with us for the foreseeable future. So how do we take advantage of the new jobs that are being created and make sure that people are ready for them and place into them quickly? Secondly, how do we take advantage of now the ubiquity of technology to give people more access to more opportunities? More and more, we are seeing the job and the location of the worker not being tied together. We've seen that a lot more things can be done virtually than we ever thought before. How do we take advantage of that? And additionally, how do we make sure on the skill side that we do the same? This is why the conversation around things like internet and broadband access is critical, because particularly for low-income communities, for those who have been left out for a long time, that's going to be their lifeline to many of the jobs and the skills they need to be successful. How do we take advantage of that right now? And then lastly, I think, and this is more of a higher level concern, but I think it's important. CFR President Richard Haass launched this Future of Work Task Force 3 years ago now, actually, but that's when we launched. Someone asked him, why does a foreign policy think tank care about this? And what he said was, if we don't get the future of work right, it's not just going to impact our economy domestically. It's going to impact the state of political discourse here domestically, which will affect our ability to be a strong nation abroad. And so when we think about the future of work, how do we lift our eyes to the horizon a little bit and think of not just how do we make sure we put people back to work, but how do we build back in a much better way than we did before? And how do we make sure we don't simply go back to what we had, but build something better than that the American people deserve and all the people in your jurisdictions deserve. And I think it's a chance not just to do what we've done, but to do what we should. And so I'm really eager to have this conversation with you, happy to dive into any of the points that I brought up. And Irina, I'll throw it back to you.
Great, thank you so much, TK, appreciate it. So now to all of you for questions and comments to share best practices as we typically do in this forum. You can click on the participants icon and raise your hand, or else if you're on a tablet, click on the more button and raise your hand. You'll see the raise your hand in there. So let's see if we have any questions or comments queuing up. Okay, people are being quiet so far. So TK, there are a couple things I wanted to just dig into. You know, you talked about automation and workers being displaced by technology. So how are we going to, you know, retool those people, reskill those people when, and COVID ostensibly, you know, probably has accelerated it more than we ever thought. It, you know, it's here before we knew it.
Absolutely. And so in the body of work that I lead now, I'll say a couple of things. How do we reskill and upskill? Those are two different things, those folks, particularly folks who have been displaced recently, and also folks who frankly have had a hard time getting into the job market for a long period of time. A couple of things. One, we have to really rethink how we do workforce development, job training. I think the governor of Rhode Island, she used this phrase once, and I've stolen it from her. But one of the phrases that we hear a lot, that she uses a lot, excuse me, is we need to stop using the train and pray approach. And what I mean by that is I train people and I pray that there is a job for them. What we need to do is tie the jobs that we're training for directly to employer demand. And we need to be pushing employers to, number one, be very precise about the skills that they say that they need. And secondly, we need to push them to make sure that once people have those skills, it's easy for them to make it into the HR office, into the interview office, and into the job. We don't make that as easy as we should right now. Again, I always use that example of the administrative assistant. Most administrative assistants don't have a college degree, but most postings require one. Why? And again, that's us as a system having to be more thoughtful than we ever have been. So one, we need to train for demand. And when we're training, we need to be training not simply for a credential awarded, which is super important, but we need to be training with the end of getting that person into work. I have been as extreme as saying, I think that no publicly funded job training should be done unless there is a job at the end of it. Because particularly for someone who's been out of work, to ask them to go through job training without that promise, or at least the high level of certainty, is too big a risk for them. So we've got to make sure that training is effective and tied to employer demand. That's one. I think two, we know that technology is going to become an even bigger part of the American workforce. We have 32 million Americans who are not comfortable using a computer. And if you look at the amount of those Americans who have access to training to get better, only 10% of them do. And so we know there are going to be certain skills that are going to be ubiquitous across jobs, because all jobs are now technology jobs. How are we training across our entire workforce for basic digital literacy? Everything from turning your computer on and using Microsoft Office all the way to high level things like coding, AI, machine learning, quantum, which is down the pike. The third thing that I would say is when we think about workforce development, many jurisdictions think about workforce development as something that happens once someone leaves high school. I think those who have really been in the space know that these are things that we should be talking about when children are young. So when we see things like the Computer Science for All movement in K-12, the opportunity for high school students to get externships, actually being in the job while they're still students, that they can understand what it's like to be in the workforce, as well as actually gaining connections that can help them in their career. That's really critical. So one, how do we make sure we are tying training to demand? Two, how do we make sure that we're giving every worker digital skills across portfolios so that they can use them in any job? And then thirdly, how do we make sure that we're starting those things young so that, again, when people come out of high school, they are already developed for our workforce?
Great. Let's go to Ray McDonald, who's a city council member in Conroe, Texas. So please accept the unmute prompt before asking your question.
Yep.
Can you hear me?
Yep.
We can hear you.
Sorry, I'm in a crowded place. One of the typists at the beginning of my article, but some of the, and by the way, great points you're making. I love what you're bringing up there. As we go back from COVID, struggling with people, being afraid of people and working next to people, you know, how does this affect the way we move forward? I love what you said, not just coming back to what we had, but looking forward to what we, you know, to something new. I wanted you to kind of just unpack that a little bit. What do you kind of think it might, what are some of those new things we're looking at, not going back to the old?
Yep. And so, Ray, I lost a little bit of you, but I think what I heard you ask was basically, how will the workforce change going forward when for potentially the foreseeable future, it'll be hard and people may be afraid of working next and in close proximity to other people or serving other people in close proximity? How are we going to think about that? And so I think about this in a couple of ways. One, it means we're going to be more dependent upon technology. We already have seen that. I'm sure all of us had never really used Zoom before 6 months ago, and now we've all gotten probably pretty good at it. Not everyone has the privilege to do that. So again, going back to that digital skills piece, we've got to make sure that those are ubiquitous. To be honest, it's quickly, if we're doing job training, let's say you're doing job training to be a pipe fitter, part of how, using Zoom should be part of that. Because again, whatever you're doing, these virtual technologies, particularly those that are used for communication, like a Zoom, like a Citrix, like a pick your mode, is going to be really, really critical. I think that's number one. I think number two, what we're also seeing is, and this is a place where I think jurisdictions can be really forward thinking, what are the job opportunities that are being created because of this very, very strange environment? One thing that you're seeing right now, particularly as folks are trying to figure out what to do about school, is you're seeing right now a bunch of, and it's actually happening in my household, how can we come up with safe ways for kids to interact with other kids? Whether it's for my son's story, he was supposed to start a 3-year-old soccer and it didn't quite work out. But you're finding right now, seeing popping up across the country, matching services to match parents with other parents who can get their kids together in safe ways so that they can have play dates. Similarly, you're seeing at a higher level, hey, how do we come up with safe ways to do education without dealing with potentially having my kid go back to a school? You're seeing, I use those as examples, not saying whether they're good or bad, but what it shows is, the thing about Americans is that during adversity, Americans innovate. And so the question is, as jurisdictions, how can we sit on top of those innovations and figure out how to scale them, accelerate them, and also help support them? I'll use an example from my home state of Maryland, again, contact tracing. We basically created a contact tracing core across 4 of our counties where literally we have people who are unemployed and we are reemploying them right now at a wage of between $35,000 and $40,000 per year to go do contact tracing. We're kind of probably, I'd say, in the top quartile in terms of reinfection rates and cases, but we basically had people who needed work, found a need, trained them, and got them back into the workforce doing good for the state, but also being able to put food on their table. And so what I would say is, one, how do we basically get those digital skills ubiquitous? Two, how do we take advantage of those new innovations that are coming up? And then three, where do we as a municipal official in New York City, how do we as cities accelerate that and create opportunities that solve a problem that we have from a public health perspective, but also solve an employment problem that we have in our jurisdiction?
Great, thank you. We got a question from William Tran. How do we adequately provide internet access to rural areas around the country? And do you see that there will be a dramatic push for updating infrastructure in the next years? Because obviously, you know, we're having this rural or urban divide. And if Zoom is the way of the future, people can't access the internet, it's not equitable.
No, and I'll add a little bit on that question, which is this is not just a suburban, this is not just a rural issue. This is an urban and suburban issue. If you actually look at the data, the majority of people in this country who are unconnected live in urban and suburban communities. The sources of that digital divide are different in different places. For urban and suburban communities, usually because the options available are too expensive for folks who don't have means. Whereas in rural communities, it's the cost issue and the fact that there may not be an option available to them. So I will say absolutely, I see this getting better in the next few years. One, because, and I think school is what's done it. I think for those of us who have kids who've had to be home with them and figure out how to help them learn on Zoom, we've realized that frankly, if your kids don't have access to an internet connection, they don't have access to education. In my home state of Maryland, we aren't going back to school in person before February 1st. And in fact, it is possible that that date may get pushed back even further. So I think the focus on it, particularly in the education sense, has created a need and an urgency more than I've ever seen nationally on these issues. The question for rural communities is, will we have the investment? For rural communities, we generally need an investment of fiber infrastructure, backhaul. I won't get into all the technical pieces to make that happen. And the thing that I'm really looking to see is, in the meantime, until we get those things, are there stopgap measures? We have seen some solutions like, for example, can we give out connected devices? Meaning I basically have a tablet with a wireless card in it where it has a network like a phone, but I can use it like a tablet. That's one very tactical example. But I think this will get better. It has to, because if you don't get people that access, they don't have access to education. I also tell people from an employment point of view, I ask people, well, when was the last time you filled out a job application on paper? I usually don't get many hands when I ask that question. So I think the answer is yes. I think school has driven the issue. And the question is, for rural communities, will we see the investment? Will we see the stopgap solutions while we make those investments?
Great. The next question will go to, I think the hand just went down. Signe. Oh, there we are. Friedrichs.
Hi there.
Thank you.
Am I unmuted? Okay.
You are. Thank you. And please identify yourself.
My name is Signe Friedrichs. I'm a town council member in Herndon, Virginia. And I have a question that deals with kind of using other countries' ideas maybe to help us. And I don't know if this is antiquated or not, but when I was a student and I studied German, and when I spent some time in Germany, part of our curriculum was to go around to other schools and find out how the gymnasium worked and how the different kinds of schools worked. Right. And Germany seemed to have a system where they figured out how many people they were going to need to do what job, and specifically tasked those schools with training people for that job. And it doesn't seem like we do that here. I may be wrong about that, but there was a direct pipeline, basically. They were saying, well, we're not going to waste any time here. We need 6 welders. We need 25 plumbers. We need, you know, someone who can discuss Descartes. And that's what they did. I don't know how successful it was. It seemed very successful at the time. And I know, because we have a federal form of government, perhaps that would need to be something that a state did rather than the overall government. But do you have any thoughts on that matter? I don't know if this is very antiquated or what.
No, I mean, I'll say, if you look at Germany right now from a comparison of COVID infection rates, but also their economic situation, they're in a much better place than we are. And part of it is, someone once told me that the U.S. has an unemployment system. The Germans have a re-employment system. They have a job. They have a system built to get people to work and back into work if they fall out of it. There are a couple of reasons for that. One, they are a much more centralized form of government. So again, that was a national decision versus a local decision. That's something that does complicate these efforts. You know, we have, I believe, if I do my figures correctly, 14,000 school districts, and as an example, and I believe it's almost close to 100,000 schools. All of them managed by different school boards and things like that, which you all as local officials understand unbelievably well. But let's take apart what you said, which is there were a couple things that were happening. One, someone somewhere had some clear idea of what demand was from the job market, number one. So this, in that case, it was the government, but it could be anybody. That's number one. Two, they had a system of creating people with those skills to take those jobs. Again, in their case of schools, but it could be anyone for us. So the question is, how do we ubiquitize those two capacities? And one of the things that makes it possible is that, frankly, government just frankly listens to business. And what that means, listens to business, means business is precise in saying, here's what I think we're gonna need. And not just saying, I'm gonna need welders, but saying, look, a good welder at my company can do these 5 things. You know, whenever I speak to employers, I am always pushing them to be super precise about what they need, because at times I find employers are not as precise as they should be. If you look at most jobs, they comprise of 32 separate tasks. Again, I always push employers, can you name those 32 separate tasks so that when you're hiring, you can hire not for necessarily a credential or some marker that just fits in your head in terms of what makes a good person, but very precisely what is in that job. And then number two, the schools are responding very, very quickly in real time to produce those things. When I ask employers, how quickly between when you tell me you have a job to when it's filled is too slow? And they're like, I generally hear 90 to 180 days, and really closer to 90 days. In Germany, they have a system that can pivot super quickly to create those skills. And I'll be honest, in the States, we don't have anything that can move that quickly, whether that be at K-12 level or at the higher ed space. So if I had to say what we need to do, how do we have a clear idea of demand locally, statewide, nationally? And secondly, how do we have a system, K-12, but I'd also say higher ed, I spend a lot of time in the community college space, that moves just as quickly so that we can fill demand. The last thing I'll say, and this is an important thing, we have to train not just for a job, because we know jobs are going to change because of changing technology, but also careers. And so the question is not, when I train you, not simply am I helping you for this job you're going to get, but I'm hopefully also giving you capacities that will help you in job 2, 3, 4, down your career. That's the best training. And again, that's going to require a little bit more than beyond what you ask, but that's my initial thoughts. And it's what the Germans generally do well. And what right now it's redounded to their benefit. And we're suffering because we don't have some of those capacities now.
Do you want to respond to that, Sydney, or shall we go on to the next?
I really appreciate what you said. And it brought to mind one other question that I wanted to mention. I have a liberal arts education. I'm in my late 50s. That was what we all did when we were teenagers. But one of the things that they constantly reinforced to us was you have to prepare yourself for change all the time. Right. You have to know that the skill you have now isn't the skill you're going to need. So how do you throughout your life, or how do we as a government help people, if that's what we want to do, reimagine themselves every, you know, I don't think every 90 days, but like you suggested, but with the job changes, but you know, every 5 or so years, our jobs are going to be very different. How do we keep sane and retrain ourselves at the same time while we're doing our job and raising our families and all that stuff? So that was just one of the things that your thoughts raised in my mind.
No, absolutely. I think, again, I've heard this concept. We talk about resilience in terms of disaster recovery, but when we think about the economy, we want workers who are resilient, not simply where I not only have taught you the skills that you need to be successful now, but I've also taught you the capacity to learn new skills and new capacities over the course of your career. So I'll say a couple things. One, I started my career, I taught second grade in Brooklyn, New York when I first started. And when I think about the K-12 system, we spent a lot of time in the K-12 system teaching discrete bodies of knowledge, which is very important, no question. What I'd argue is more important is, because right now I can look up anything I want to on Google and I can know when the French Revolution started, or I can go on my calculator and calculate this. But what's more important is, are we teaching critical thinking, problem solving, leadership, communication, things that machines can't do, that no matter what job you're in will be super effective. When I talk to employers, they generally tell me I can train anyone on the technical skills that I need in 90 to 100 days. What I need are those things that machines can't do. Give me someone with those skills and I'll figure out the rest. That's one. I think two, as we think, this is a policy recommendation, we put it into our report, we need a way for Americans to finance their reskilling across their career. Right now, if I want to, for example, learn full stack engineering, I need to drop out. Particularly if I have a family, I have to figure out something to pay my rent, my mortgage, and buy my groceries, and do 10 to 11 hours a day to learn that new skill. We have no system of financing for that. Germany does. So how do we think about that for people who need new work? I'll use another example. If you think about a 4-year degree, we have a system of financing. It has lots of problems that I can go into, but we have a system that if you don't have the money for that right now, you can borrow for it. We have no system like that that's analogous for short-term skill training that can teach your capacity to get you into the next step in your career. we've had thoughts about basically how do we basically make those subsequents available for that, but we're still not there. So I'd say two things. One, how do we make sure that K-12 education focuses on those human skills that can't be done by a machine, as well as discrete bodies of knowledge? It shouldn't be either or, you need to put them together. And then secondly, we need a way for Americans to pay for and sustain themselves while they get new skills so they can get back in the workforce.
So Sarah Saruri from the Boston Mayor's Office raises the point that we need better data on work from home trends to analyze what is happening in the U.S. workforce. Do you have any recommendations on sources for that information? Is it being collected? Sure. Well, any other perspectives to add?
Sure. In my prior place of work, we did a lot of work with Mayor Walsh, and so it's good to see someone from Boston there. I lived in the Boston area for about 7 years of my life. I'll say a couple of things. So there are a number of sources that I can name, sources like Burning Glass, sources like MC, sources like actually the regional Federal Reserve Banks actually do amazing work. The Philadelphia Reserve Bank actually did a great study just recently, not just on trends, but also what are the careers that lead to other careers? What are the skills that build on themselves? And so this report just came out, I want to say in July. So I really encourage folks to take a look. But what I'll say here is, while macro trends are helpful, I do believe they are. You always need to have that layer of data. What I find is at times, and I remember this from my own days in government, you use the data to, in some ways, avoid the conversation with the people who have the jobs, who are the employers, whether they be small businesses, large businesses. And so the best approach is having the macro data, but then having those regular contact with employers and forcing employers to be specific and can be committing to hiring for what they need in quick time frame. That will always give you the best projection of what you need. I'm in Prince George's County here in Maryland. What did MGM say in terms of how many groundskeepers they are going to hire, or how many accountants they're going to hire? What did Marriott say in terms of how many people they need to do sales? Things like that. That's always good. I find that bottom-up data is just as important as the top-down data.
Thank you. I'm waiting to see if we have other questions or comments. And just wanted to talk, you do a lot of work with community colleges. What are the primary concerns you're finding about education now during the pandemic, including, I know a lot of people are thinking and stressing, quite frankly, about the reopening of K-12 schools and universities that are starting. I mean, we saw the case in Georgia, and I know that there's been a patchwork of some, you said Maryland, you're going to be remote through February and perhaps longer. New York has announced that schools can reopen as long as there's, following CDC guidelines, et cetera.
So absolutely, I lead this community college growth engine fund. And so first there's the safety concern. Most of the schools that we're working with, as well as higher ed broadly, is doing some type, very few of them are doing full in-person instruction back in the fall. They're all worried about, number one, the safety of their students and the surrounding communities. But the second thing, which I see, which has been a big pain point, is two things. One, very, very practical, which is because many of these schools are going to some type of virtual instruction, you're seeing many students, for reasons that are personal to them, saying, I might want to defer a year. I might want to delay my decision to go into higher education. Not bad. The question, the challenge is that that's 25, 30, 40%, even more of the incoming class that you're expecting. That is a huge revenue impact. Huge revenue impact. And so every school is dealing with that. And one can imagine, as they're making these decisions, that's probably in the back of their mind. How do I make sure that I'm around in the fall of 2021 to make sure that I can continue to serve students? So number one, the revenue business model impact of having to a number of their students defer entry. Number two is the re-engineering of how they deliver their instruction. So again, let's use workforce development. Let's say you're doing an apprenticeship around construction, for example. You're used to doing that in person, on site, side by side. That's the nature of apprenticeship as we've understood it for thousands of years. Now you've got to figure out how you do that virtually. And that is a pedagogical challenge. And as a teacher, I'll say, very few teachers are taught, whether that be at the higher ed level or the K-12 level, how to do that intuitively. They have to learn it along the way. So those are the two big piece of heartburn that I have seen and felt from many of the higher ed students that we've worked with. I'll say one thing that's that I find heartening that is the opportunity that they see is there is such a need in terms of people who need work and work that needs to get done, that particularly community colleges are seeing themselves as a bridge. At the Community College Growth Engine Fund, at my place of work, we're basically trying to put a structure on that and give support so that they can build those bridges. So they see an opportunity, but the business model concerns and the pedagogical concerns and changes that are coming definitely give heartburn and, during this time of COVID.
So I know one of the recommendations in the task force was the licensing requirements, mm-hmm. that having more portability of licenses to cross state lines.
Correct.
Are you seeing now with COVID that states are lifting, you know, making it easier? Not that, you know, people can travel, but in any case, it's a little bit ironic, but...
I think the honest answer, at least from what I've seen from local and state jurisdictions, is I think most of you, then when they say this, when you say this point, agree. This is regardless of party or geography. I think the question is just bandwidth, because you have to figure out how you're going to pass the law because your legislature can't meet, pass the regulation because your Department of Labor maybe can't meet. And also you have, of course, schools, safety, health, things like that. So I find people agree with this issue, but then just the bandwidth concern. That's, I think, number one. I think number two, adjacent to that, and I wrote about this particularly in the report, is we do have some states where there are barriers to licensure that don't quite make sense. So for example, there are still a number of states where usually there's some type of kind of governing body at the state level that says who can get a credential and who can't for things like plumbing, being an electrician, things like that. And at times, things like a felony record or a felony on your record can be a barrier to you getting that licensure. You potentially are re-entering society. You want to be an economically productive member, but your prior record, which you've served your debt to society for, stands in the way. And so I think at this point, the big question is how do we remove all barriers to licensure, whether they be geography, whether they be potential past record, things that can't be controlled that don't bear on people's ability, because particularly in high growth fields that we need, we can afford to have these types of barriers.
William Tran had another comment question. How do we assist college students who have not received financial assistance through COVID-19 relief packages while also helping them to continue their college education and get jobs in a new job market?
This is a great question. This is, I think, a million-dollar question. I think one of the things, whatever one's thoughts are on all the packages that have passed Congress, I think one thing that has been tough is direct kind of aid to individuals. Particularly students, particularly those who have not necessarily started their economic journeys yet. It's a place I think that we've found ourselves wanting. And so don't have answers, but I think some outcomes that I think we do need to look for are one, how do we get some of those students into some of the work that needs to get done? We have seen places like, I used to get in my home state, city of Baltimore, or places like Massachusetts who have basically said for folks who are not in work or have been displaced from their college, let's put you into contact tracing. I use that as an example, but there are more types of work like that I think we can create, find. And again, it serves a public purpose, but also an economic purpose for that individual. I think number two, a really big question is this is probably a federal issue, but how do we make sure that students who have been displaced through no fault of their own due to COVID can still get some access to the aid that they would have accessed otherwise, whether that be Pell, hopefully reasonable student loans, things like that. So those are some things that we can do, but I'll be honest, it's a knotty problem that we've just not quite figured out. And, you know, if left to me, this is something that we would have figured out during when we were figuring out our rescue packages, probably earlier in the year, that we could have taken care of.
So I think TK's state and local officials are facing a lot of challenges that start with the budget as they're trying to prepare and deal with this pandemic and safely reopening schools and whatnot. I mean, how would you prioritize what needs to happen in order to tackle all the different things? And there are so many issues that have been surfaced that were there, but have become really you know, are in our face, from health to clean energy to, you know, the list can go on. Education.
Yeah. I am very loath to give a mayor or a governor advice on how they should prioritize, but I would, but let me talk about this area of employment and skills. So let me talk about that. Because I think for every official that I talk to, they generally have roughly two or three priorities. One is, of course, keeping people healthy and safe. Secondly, is getting people back to work. And so when we think about that, I would really go back to, I think, where I began, which is, as much devastation, I think, as we've seen in the economy, there are places that are still stable and growing. And the question is, how do we ascertain exactly what those jobs are, the skills that are needed from their employers, and then how are we working with any institution we can, K-12, higher ed, community-based organizations, institutions that we've not even thought of yet, and support them in training people for those jobs. That's number one. How do we, again, match skill and demand? I would say that it's a huge, huge need. That's number one. I think number two, there is work in the country that can now be done in a different location. So again, whether it's, you know, take something like, if you use Google Map, things like geotagging, where basically people are looking at images and tagging certain things, that can be done from anywhere. How do we basically, if I were mayor of a city, I'd be looking for what types of jobs are like that? How do I basically connect those to people who are unemployed? And literally, if I need to make sure that all of them have an internet connection and a computer, I'm gonna do it so that they can do that work. Because however much I pay for that internet and computer, it's less than them being on unemployment, public assistance, potentially getting involved in illicit activity. So how do we basically take advantage of work that may not be where I am, but that my people can do? I think lastly, and this is a thing that falls into this, because we have to figure out where is the work going to come from. All the public officials who are on this call, I know, have long stories about the small businesses that were not helped and did not get enough help during the whole PPP crisis, particularly those that were minority women-owned, people who weren't big. And so how do we think about small business relief? A number of proposals have been put out there, but thinking about, even if it's some type of debt vehicle, meaning someone has to take out a low interest loan, how do we keep as many of those businesses open as we can? Because what we saw from the Great Recession was that it is far easier to, it's far less costly to keep someone in a job than they lose that job and you have to get them back in the job market. So I would say, one, how do I train people for the jobs that I have that are growing in my local jurisdiction as quickly as I can? Two, how do I train them for jobs that may not be in my jurisdiction but can be done virtually? Thirdly, for the small businesses particularly that I have, how do I keep them open so that they can keep employing people? Because it's better to have those folks employed, keeping that business open, whether it be hardware store, barbershop, dry cleaner, than to have them on the unemployment rolls, and then years later, potentially years later, have to pull them back into the market, which we know is economically difficult.
Are there some sectors that you see at risk of not having enough people to fill those jobs?
I mean, we're in some ways, we've seen some of these shortages expand. In the allied health fields, everything from doctors, nurses, phlebotomists, you still, particularly because we're seeing rising healthcare loads, and this is differential a little bit throughout the country, but we're still not seeing, I've not seen a single healthcare provider say, I have enough of all those people. That's number one. Number two, in the technology stack. So whether that be data science, user experience engineer, back-end engineer, but also a bunch of the middle skill jobs, things around things like database security, cloud infrastructure, things like that, still not enough of those. And if anything, they need more because we're relying more on those technologies to run more and more of our society. And anyone who works in cloud, for example, has seen demand dramatically increase because we're relying more on services like Netflix and Amazon to frankly make sure we all don't go insane inside of our houses now and for the last 4 months. So those are places that frankly are still had a hard time filling. And I think that, and if you're lucky enough to either be located near something like that, or your folks can access that virtually, hop on that because they are still hiring. I live in the DC metro area. Amazon is not just still hiring, they are hiring more people. They're hiring at a faster rate than they were before COVID, partially because of their success during this crisis. And we can argue about why that is. But there are examples like that in most jurisdictions, and we really want to make sure that local folks jump on that because I think it's going to be critical to making sure that people can't sustain themselves during this time.
And we have a question from Representative Pamela Anderson. From North Dakota.
Thank you. I just have a comment about the small businesses loans. And actually, it came from one of the first of these conferences I listened to. Mm-hmm. We're very fortunate to have the Bank of North Dakota, you know, our own state bank. But after listening, we have a micro business loan, mm-hmm. 10 full-time equivalents or less, $25,000, no collateral, a little bit collateral up to $50,000, and a payment plan is 1% for 10 years. So basically, it's, you know, $9,000. I mean, so we're keeping some of our small businesses going, I think, because I listened and ran out to one of these first webcasts. So, and then I also have a question.
Sure, ma'am.
A comment, maybe. I think what COVID has done is higher paying jobs, you can work from home, lower paying, you can't.
Right.
So how is that going to change how people think about their careers? How, I don't know. Do you just comment about that?
Absolutely. On the first point, Bank of North Dakota is, whether people want a public owned bank or not, but what you all have done is, I would say, absolutely right. Again, in the state of Maryland, we are down almost half the amount of small businesses relative to January, relative now than to January. And that is a huge, huge concern because that's where the majority of people work. And what you saw with PPP is that if you look at who got loans, who were small businesses, most of them were over 100 people. Nothing wrong with those businesses. When you look at businesses that were 25 people, 10 people, the percentages were infinitesimal because frankly, they didn't have the banking relationships and the time to go through the whole process to get those loans. And again, those people are employing a huge part of our workforce. So I think all those schemes types that you described make a ton of sense, particularly focused on those small local businesses. The broader concern that you brought up is really important, which is that higher paying jobs, you can work from home, but lower paying jobs, potentially you can't. And so what's interesting is if you look at a lot of the jobs that have now been deemed essential, they fit in that category. The folks who stock our shelves at grocery stores, the folks who are working at, you know, certain hospital jobs, public safety workers, things like that. I would argue one thing that it's done is that what COVID has done is it's shown that some of those quote unquote lower paying jobs, low skilled jobs are actually quite important. And, you know, when I took economics, things that are important, you should pay for. And so figuring out how we sustain people who are working those jobs and also how we keep them safe during, which is, and again, I know this is a big area of controversy, but how do we make sure businesses are keeping their workers safe so that they can do some of that work is really, really critical. And I think has to be a part of the lexicon of business moving forward. You know, again, you know, businesses must have insurance for certain things. Businesses have to have certain safety protocols. We know, sadly, that pandemic, this may not be the last pandemic that we see, and we've got to make sure our businesses are prepared for that. And we as a society have to make sure that we are willing to pay for people who are doing essential work, even though we didn't consider it that before COVID.
Thank you. And I'm pleased that our webinars are having that kind of impact. So thank you for that. Sure. So Sarah Cerui has raised her hand and hopefully her microphone is working. So we're going to give it a try from the Boston Mayor's office.
Hi, yeah. Can you hear me?
Yes,
we can.
Oh, you can? Okay, good. No one could hear me today. I just wanted to sort of dovetail off of, you know, some of your comments because, you know, and I sort of study this stuff too. So, you know, I think, and just from my work in the mayor's office and the Office of Workforce Development, and then sort of my research work. I mean, I think it really is in the immediate term, I think that in order for us to really understand, you know, what are the work of the future trends, we really need to a much better understanding of how COVID is accelerating digitalization of firms. So, you know, with the need to reassure customers that consumer experiences are, you know, compatible with minimal sort of social contact and human interaction? Like, how is this impacting investment in automation and interactive communication and self-serving kind of digital tools? And I think, as you were saying, you know, kind of this educational inflation across a lot of occupations that we're seeing is kind of a proxy for digital literacy skills and technology skills in a lot of ways. So, and then sort of on the other side of that is, you know, the workforce development field hasn't, in the case of some rural areas, telecommuting or remote work jobs hasn't really been a major focus. But now, you know, we're going to probably see the expansion of remote work jobs, which will potentially have some impact on localities in terms of competition, labor force, labor market competitions. But there's on the other side of that, there's obviously a lot of opportunities. So those are two areas that I think are really sort of important to understand as we go forward and, you know, as we kind of emerge out of this pandemic mode.
I agree with everything that you've said. I think, again, we still don't understand enough of what's happening within firms. And I will push and say, I don't know if firms totally have a handle on what's happening within themselves right now, again, because people are really just, again, trying to make it from day to day. You know, again, I have a smile from Sarah because, you know, I used to work for General McChrystal and we've, and we lent some assistance to the city of Boston. And so we got to work with, besides amazing folks like her. So really got to see her on the call. I think secondly, though, how we think about what will this workforce look like? I expect, I think most of us have seen it, that jobs that people said have to be done from a certain place, you are going to see some loosening of that. And the question is, how do we take advantage of that? And I think what Sarah's speaking to is, and this is particularly, I think, a city concern is, oh, well, people not feel like they need to live in the city anymore, define the city as you will, because they can be in other places and work far more remotely. I think the question then becomes, okay, from an economics point of view, what other things can I give people that they wouldn't get otherwise? Some of it is social proximity, some bits of amenities. But I think cities particularly have, I think, some things to think about because, one, you know, you how do we deal with the concern of people? Something we have that density, if this happens again, may not make them or their family safe. That's one. Probably a dealable concern, but it's one that maybe has to be confronted. And then I say, secondly, how do we make sure that people still feel a need to be in the city if even though they may not need to live there to be successful? I think on the flip side, for your suburbs, your exurbs, for your rural communities, this is potentially an opportunity. You all may be able to provide things the city can't provide, whether it be some land, being able to see the stars at night, whatever it is, as long as they can connect. You know, I think about a city, and it's still a city, but in a place like Tennessee, I think about Chattanooga, Tennessee, who has seen, and I'm sure if we have anyone from Chattanooga on the line, but they invested in a broadband network, which is world-class. That has changed their city from an economic and social perspective and created opportunities for their residents that didn't exist otherwise. And now I imagine Andy Burke, who's the mayor there, if I know him well enough, is thinking about how he can position his city as one where people can move to and still work in places like New York and Boston and Philly and Chicago. Arena, you're on mute.
Thank you very much for having me follow my own advice here. Let's go next to Uche Iwohimu, and excuse me for mispronouncing it. So please pronounce it correctly and tell us where you're from.
Can you hear me?
Yes, sir.
We can.
All right, Uche Iwohimu, I'm from California, Assemblywoman Buffy Wicks office.
Excellent.
And Chike, good to see you. How are you doing?
You too, sir.
From my home city of Washington, D.C. area. So so real quick, I just wanted to ask if you have seen a rise in new startups since this COVID-19 environment, and if so, what sector, what area do you see the rise, and what are the challenges we anticipate seeing in this, you know, coming for them?
It is a great question, and particularly in places like California. I'll be frank, this has been a tough time for startups. And let me, small business, but also starts in particular for a couple of reasons. One, unless you just raised a huge amount of venture capital, you don't have a big cushion of cash. And so a lot of startups basically saw their customer pipelines dry up. So unless you had the money and the cash to make it through a tough time, you are likely cash strapped and you had to lay people off, or you potentially had to shut your doors. But you have seen, again, in very particular places, particular industries, I've seen things in the health field, the education space, as well as the broad kind of virtual communication space, where you have seen new startups pipe up. But I would argue, and I've not seen the full data on this, so I don't want to quote a statistic that I don't have. My instinct is that startup activity is down, or that the amount of startups is down in this country, probably pretty significantly relative to January. But I think there are a couple of places in some of the fields that I named where you will see activity. This is something I frankly do lay at the feet of, I think, our incomplete and not robust enough response for small businesses. Again, most startups are not 100 people, they're not 500 people, they are 10 to 100 people. And things like PPP, which is a great idea, I think had a positive impact on the economy, did not get to enough of our small and growing businesses. And then layer on top of that, led by people from an array of diverse communities. So I actually think, when I think about what public policy folks can do, I think it's, how do I help these small businesses be successful? And in exchange for, they need to take care of their workers, which is, hey, if we're supporting you as a state, you've got to keep people on at least at the level that you're at right now. And then secondly, which I think is what's coming next, how do we think about helping startups and businesses more broadly invest in those workers' training and capacity to be more successful? A paper that I'm working on right now is is basically, how do we change the tax treatment for training? Meaning, right now, if I as a business buy an Escalade, I can depreciate that and get a tax write-off for it. But if I train a worker with a new skill, I have to treat that as an expense. How do we make sure that we treat investment in skills like we treat investments in equipment? Because that's better for the business. Because we want businesses to invest in workers so they're more productive on the job. And it's better for society, because if that worker leaves that job, they have skills and investments they can take somewhere else and still be economically productive. So I think that's what potentially is coming next. How do we make sure that we are investing in the workers so that they're productive no matter where they are? So invest in startups, but also invest in the people who work there so that they can be productive wherever they go next.
Chike, we are almost at the end of our time, and I just wondered if there are, since we are the Council on Foreign Relations, any examples of from around the world of job retraining that you think are countries are doing really well, and what the U.S. can learn from them?
So one example is which you spoke about, is Germany. So again, Germany is successful, one, because of a pretty tight coordination between their businesses and their government and their educational institutions. That's one. Two, they have treated their technical and vocational system not as a stepchild, but as an equal to their traditional liberal arts, what we call college preparatory curriculum. And I'd argue in the States, part of the reason that at times we've had a negative impression of vocational education or technical education is because we've never invested in it or really treated it seriously. In Germany, it is an equal system with just as smart of people, just as robust of investment and infrastructure, and we need to have a similar view here. I would say on the broader kind of economic stability side, looking at a number of things that the UK has done, particularly around helping businesses keep people on staff, I won't have the numbers right, but basically they're investing in businesses keeping on their workers up to 80% of their wages capped at a certain amount. Huge investment. But I would argue that is going to cost you, that's going to cost them far less than having those people out of work and trying to get them back in the job market weeks, months, and years from now. I'll say lastly, one place I'll say very domestically that I think has done a really good job of this is looking at places like Chicago with orgs like Skills for Chicago Land's Future. Tight coordination with employers, working directly with community colleges, community-based organizations to train people for jobs that actually exist, so that they're not simply training, we're praying that there's a job for them, but actually having a job for them. One initiative that I'd have people watch, I'm not sure if we have anyone from Rhode Island on the call, but Governor Raimondo just announced Back to Work RI, which is gonna be a statewide initiative doing this exact thing. figuring out the jobs that exist, working with any educational institution to prepare them, and then doing that and getting people into those jobs as quickly as possible. So I think those are some examples from other states and other countries that I think would be really powerful during this environment. But I also say, I think the thing that Americans do well in adversity is innovate. And I also think that for all the people who are on this call, we definitely need that innovation now from you. And I think having your ear to the ground in your communities, which I'm sure you all do, is going to help you surface those. And again, I think what we need you doing is standing there in the public square, making sure that we are investing in helping those folks as much as possible.
What a great way to end this discussion, PK. Thank you very much. We really appreciate your insights, and we will share with all of you the video link, the transcript, as well as a link to the Future of Work Task Force report that PK was a member of and referenced earlier in this call. And I encourage you to follow him on Twitter at CRAGUH. So you should subscribe to his feed and follow his thought leadership. PK, it's always a pleasure to hear your insights and your analysis. So thank you very much.
Thank you so much to the council for having me. And thank you to all of you for what you do and for being on this webinar today.
Terrific. Stay well and safe, everyone.
Thank you. Same.